The Pearl of Great Price Lecture Series, given by Dr. Hugh Nibley. Today's lecture is entitled, The Babylon Creation Myth.
Now, this, we're just going to put on the tail end of this, because it's, I say it's important that we put it on. Is this connected here now? Yeah. And it's... This is what we want to see. Yeah, that's right. That's the way it should be. Wait a minute now. Focus it and the... Yes, from the ancestors, from the... All that went above and all that went below. Yeah, that'll be good enough. And I'll just turn off the light for a minute here. It won't take long. Hey, would you get the light there just a second? Just makes it a little bit clearer. Just the final things we want to take into consideration here. These last two lines, it's been talking about, it starts out here in the Palace of Ptah, where life begins, to the place where all things come together and all things are brought to a conclusion. And then it starts at the top, and Osiris was, you see, submerged in the water, as it points up there, I should have a pointer here. Well, let's move it down a little. Like that. Yeah, there we are. Osiris was, he was, you see, was Osiris emerged in the water, in his water. It's interesting, it calls him his water. There's something particular about it. Even beneath, with reference to his water, and the two ladies saw him, and they were supposed to rescue him. They discerned him with their two eyes, you see. They saw him, and... Men Exen, that's right, and they hastened without delay, Mjedit, I skipped this part here, right up here, see? And Horus gave them order and commanded and cried out to them, ladies, go rescue him, take him from the water, Nedja means grab him, snatch him from the water, lay hand upon Osiris, and prevent his drowning, don't let him get completely drowned. This kefis is to prevent a thing from happening, that he drown. And then we come back to the next line, and they run around, and just in time they catch him, Hair Chariot, just in time, they catch him and drag him up, bring him up again upon the land. Well, now, he being upon the land asserts himself. He now enters through the gate, the Sebach, it also means initiation, of the glory of the land. Of the Holy Ones, the Lords of Eternity. See, he is now, the final test, of course, is the baptism. He emerges from the waters of life. Remember, this is the theme you're going to get in all your... in all your year dramas and so forth. This is the De Profundis method from De Profundis formula from the Psalms. Out of the depths I call on. It's the king, you see. He calls unto the Lord to rescue him from the depths. He has to, and the same thing happens in the first chapter of Moses in our Pearl of Great Price, where Moses comes, is delivered from the waters and comes out, and the Lord says, I'll give you power over many waters, and you shall be the king, and they shall obey you as if you were God, and you shall lead my people. It's the old acclamation of the king, the same motif that goes on here. And he's brought from the water. You'll see that, write that in this passage of Moses. It's quite relevant, actually, where the Lord says to him when he's right in First Moses here. We are. Yes, and calling upon the name of God, he beheld his glory again. He emerges again. Remember, he's overcome. He's overwhelmed by the waters, by the depths, and he calls out with his last breath of strength, he calls out to be rescued, and then God saves him out of this, delivered him, you see. Nevertheless, he saw the bitterness of hell. That means he went down into the waters. The bitterness of hell, when he saw he despaired, he gave up. You see, it says here, he feared, and as he began to fear, he saw the bitterness of hell. Then he received strength, he called upon God, and Satan was banished, and then he emerged again here, and then calling upon the Lord again, he beheld his glory, and the voice of the Lord said, you are the victor, you have won, blessed art thou the mighty, for I have chosen thee, thou shalt be made stronger than many waters. Moses was, both the Red Sea and the waters of Marah, and also the waters of death. He's calling out from here, for they shall obey thy command as if thou wert God, the king's representative on earth it is. Lo, I am with thee even to the end of thy days, for thou shalt deliver my people. See, it's God's people that Moses is delivering. The king only holds his authority this way. Well, in the same way, he emerges, and on doing so, this is what he does. He enters immediately into through the gate of the great holy ones of eternity. The word holy here is written very phonetically, Deshereo. It's Deseret. It's the word for holy, remember, set apart, sanctified, Deseret. They use that word a good deal. It's the red land, the holy land. Very special. Of course, it's the red crown of the north. It's called the Deseret crown. And the bee is the symbol, is the Deseret bee. It all goes back to her anyway. Well, and then the lords of eternity to walk upon the path, see the legs walking upon the path, to walk along the same path, the belt of him who rises in glory on the horizon along the way. That's Metchenu. Metchenu is the word for highway, and it's used all through as the way of life. The tomb of Penosiris, for example. I will teach you the way of life, the way of truth. The first psalm with Derech Rishakim Tovev. Yodev Adonai Derech Tzadikim. God knows the way of the righteous with Derech Rishakim Tovev. But the way of the wicked shall get lost in the desert. It shall perish. Tovev means to get lost in the sand and perish. So I will lead you on the way. This language all mixes in. It's very close to Old Testament and, as we say, to John and Genesis 2. Well, on the way, on the highway. See, that's his picture of a way with the milestones along it. It's the word wat for way. Notice it's our word way, wat, Watling Street in England. Wat is to wade, it's to walk along, to stand along, wat way. They cognate with our language all the way through here. Of rage, with a ray of ray, to the heavenly throne, to the great throne here. And then, there when you reach the great throne, there he shall be united in salvation and safety. This is Tzedek Sa. It means the chosen and the saved or eternal. Sa, these are the knots that you wear on your shoulder here on the sacred garment. And it represents security and safety, because the knot is when you tie a thing and make it safe. And the knot is secure and tied, and it's pronounced Sa. The Tzedek Sa, and it applies, it's the name which was later given to the palace of Luxor. But it means the holy and safe place, the place where the gods assemble. In brotherhood, notice the two brother signs, sen, sen, with a nose there for sniff, sten, sniff, and they shall kiss one another and fall upon each other's shoulders. This is like the ending of the pearl, remember, when they all greet each other. They sen, sen, and he shall be entered into the brotherhood of the gods. Sen, sen, the two brothers, you see. And our word twins, see, twain, sen, shene, Shanaim, see in Hebrew, it's Shanaim means two, but in Arabic it's tain, ten, twain. The word is twain, ten, which means two. And that's our word twain, too. Perfectly good old English. And that's the word we have here. The sewan, the twain, the sewan, of course, the dialect, you call it twain, too. But in Semitic language, it's twain, shen. Hebrew is sheni. With his brethren, the gods, as at the place of good old Ta Chenin. Ta has now become the ruler upon the earth, but now he's up in heaven. Remember, he's in the heavenly where Ta is. This is Geb before, where Ta is in the heavens, who is the Lord of eternities, the Ancient of Days, literally the Lord of years. And then he shall become the Osiris, the one who enters his temple. See, he has now been sanctified. The idea is how Osiris doesn't stay in the grave. He comes and introduces the ordinances for redemption for the dead on earth. So he enters into his temple. Here is the house of the great old man. See, the house of the man with the staff in it. He's the where's the sare. And it's rendered often the house of the Ancient of Days. In other words, God's representative on earth. Notice it's all representation here. As the Lord told Moses, as if thou wert God. We say the Egyptians always mixing these things up. You see it in the museum. Well, that's part of the scriptures. You do that. And Moses and Elijah and Elisha and so forth, the garment of Moses, and he shall then he approaches his son. Finally, then he and his son shall be brought together. His son Horus, who is reigning on the two thrones, in the embrace of his arms. This is as Sefer shows. There's the arm. You see, Mshenu. Shenu means the interior, and the At is the arm of his arms. In his arms, this is when the father and son embrace as the last act of his being initiated and set up on his throne. And then in the presence of all the gods who were before in eternity and who are after in eternity. So this takes us back into the eternal scene again. We've gone through the cycle here. Now we can turn this thing off and get on to the lesson. Now, I noticed the first time there's a good photograph of this thing in one of the books for sale over at the bookstore in the museum. The book's too expensive, prohibitive, couldn't get it. But it's the first good photograph I've ever seen, which you can actually read it from a photograph. The original Chabaco stone, the way it looks today. Yeah, so thanks for turning on the lights. Should I review this briefly now before I point out this particular thing? Remember, we said that Hermann Grappau was the author of the 3 million words of the 5-volume Egyptian dictionary. He says this theme of the creation and the world before the creation is that of the pyramid text. You'll find it in the Book of the Dead. You'll find it in the Greek and Roman temple inscriptions. You'll find it in the Old Testament. You'll find it in the Babylonian literature. You'll find it in the Rig Veda. You'll find it in the Vedas and the Sanskrit literature of India, of course. You will find it in the Old High German. You'll find it in the Gothic, in the Wesselbrunner Gebet, and you'll find it in the Veluspa of our Scandinavian ancestors and so forth, and cosmogonies. And we mentioned the passages from the Hesiod's Theogony, the oldest Greek work, talks about how it all began and so forth. And then Mirka Eliade, we mentioned also, who has done the greatest comparative work of all these, bringing the primitives with the early religion together and modern together. He says, there's always this central myth which describes the beginnings of the world, including the origin of plants, animals, and man, of marriage, of family, and death, and so forth. Taken all together, these myths of origin constitute a fairly coherent history. You'll find them the same wherever you go. It isn't the sort of thing any primitive would make up, or that you'd make up to tell a child, or you think if you go back to the primitives throughout the world, you find a vast variety of strange, exotic rites and folk. You don't. You find the same story everywhere. That's what Fraser showed, James Fraser, you know, in The Golden Bough. He looked all over the world and he found these things everywhere. His conclusion was, which was held till quite recently, that, of course people do the same things. It represents a natural degree along the development of the human mind. It's evolutionary. At a certain period of evolution, people think in these terms. Well, it's much too elaborate a story, and there's much too close parallels among it to be dismissed that way, so nobody accepts that anymore, the parallels that have come in. And in the 1930s, it was just in 1930s that at Cambridge, the Cambridge School started what they called patternism. Wherever you go in the ancient world, ancient, primitive, as you might say, or modern, you will find the same pattern being followed, the patternism. And does it go back to just some pattern in the human mind in which we just do these things spontaneously? And C.G. Jung, usually the famous German psychologist, he still maintains, he's very old now, but still going on, he maintains, yes, that there are certain primal images that we all have and so forth. But all the gaps have been filled in now, and it appears that they do have the common origin and do go back to a particular thing. Well, let me turn now quickly to the Babylonian equivalent to this. What do you find in Mesopotamia? We find here the Enuma Elish story. Unfortunately, we can't put this on reserve because the Enuma Elish is in seven tablets, and this one of Spicer only produces the last three and the first four, the creation story. That's the ones we want. I have made a summary here, which I'm going to have Xerox today, from the text published by Labatt here, and I think we can use that. Not to slow us down, just enough to show us what we're dealing with, this kind of thing we have on hand here. He says, Spicer says, who is the main student of this, he is Spicer, he's left the first four out. The struggle between cosmic order and chaos was to the ancient Mesopotamians, now this includes the Babylonians, the Sumerians, the Amorites, the people up to the north, the people of Mari, goes clear over to Ebla and so forth. This is all the eastern area. Now, their language is close to the Bible, and you notice this text, this old Babylonian text is so that it's transliterated here, and your students have had Hebrew, Arabic, won't have much trouble. You'll recognize all the words. The grammar's a little different, but you get onto that pretty quickly. And it's not bad. Of course, except the reading of the cuneiform. When you get that in the mud and all these things, anything goes, you know, just right along. It's pretty terrible. You'll have to go to Brother Pack for that. He's very good, incidentally. One of the best Babylonian men in the country is right here, BYU. The faithful drama was renewed at the term of each new year. See, they dramatized, just exactly as in Egypt, they dramatized the thing at the beginning to celebrate the beginning of the world at each new year. The epic which deals with these events was therefore, and this is important, the most significant expression of religious literature of Mesopotamia. Just as this is the most significant expression, the Memphite theology is standard and fundamental right down to the end, right down to Genesis and John. In the same way in Mesopotamia, this remains the standard text and, as he says, the most significant expression of religious literature of Mesopotamia. The work consisting of seven tablets was known in Akkadian as Enuma Elish, which means as once above. It begins with the meeting of the gods above, the great council. Well, with the meeting, there are the three. There's Ani, Enlil, there's the three on the great thrones. And is known in Akkadian as Enuma Elish, Enuma, that which was happening on high, so as it was once above, in the beginning. Enuma. In my first primeval childhood, as we read in the Pearl, remember he starts out in heaven the same way in his first primeval childhood, went on high after its opening words. It was recited with due solemnity on the fourth day of the New Year festival. It was, what's his name in his, the Babylonian scholar, name in a minute. I always say I'll think his name is it, and I do too. Can't bother to repeat it. He figured that it was given. Well, this is what happened at the new year. This is a Hopi rite, incidentally. But at the new year, the king had to go into the underworld. He went into a tomb and disappeared for 3 days in death. He has to show that he can overcome the powers of death. So he disappears into an underground vault for 3 days. While he is there, he is humiliated. He is dressed in a false robe, he's given a reed to hold in his hand, and his face is slapped by the priest until the tears run. And he puts a mock crown on. Of course, immediately you think of Jesus, King Jesus. There's a book on this by no less a person than Graves, Robert Graves. That properly humiliates him, cuts him down to size. Meantime, he has vanished in the grave. Does he have power over the resurrection? Does he have the king's secret to be resurrected? Well, on the third day, he arises. He comes triumphantly through the Ishtar gate, and as he comes through, this is recited. This is the story that's recited, reestablishing, just as it happened in Memphis there, when the king refounded the empire, when Shabako did, after it was done by Menes the First. But Menes wasn't the first, it was very ancient. In other words, this has a very old background and a worldwide background. Now, the latest study by W.G. Lambert says the first major conclusion is that epic of creation, this is not the norm of Babylonian or Sumerian cosmology. It is a sectarian and aberrant combination. It's been handed by a number of the groups. Babylon didn't have the united civilization that Egypt always had. It didn't have the one idea of the Pharaoh and so forth, the united land. It was always broken up into kingdoms and competing temples and religions and everything else. The sectarians, they all treat the same material, but they treat it in different ways. You get some of that in Egypt too, but not as much as do in Babylon. So he says, this is a sectarian and aberrant combination of mythological threads woven into an unparalleled composition. And in my opinion, he says, this composition was not earlier than 1100 B.C., so it's at least 1,000 years after the other. But you notice what they do. They have scrambled the motifs, as you can expect, but the motifs are still there. The evidence is all there, but it's scrambled. It's like when you have a stew. The stew has all been chopped up, the vegetables and things, but you can tell what went into it. You can tell there were carrots there, and you can put the carrot parts together, and the potatoes and the onions. You're not fooled at all. And even when they're badly scrambled up like this, you recognize the same familiar few motifs and so forth. But this is the most important text. So I wrote it out in the short form here, not in the short form, but as I'm going to have this Xerox and put it on reserve. But it starts out, say you're familiar, you Hebrew students and so forth, you should be able to recognize it right from the beginning here, the introduction. And Enuma Elish, as it was once above. Lanaba'u Shama'u. You notice this? When the Nabu'u, what's a Nabi? Of course, it's a prophet. It's a Naba'u to make an announcement. Naba'u, what were not announced. Shema'u, what's Shema'u? In Hebrew, they follow the Egyptian idea and call it the two heavens, Shemayim. They make it dual, plural, the two heavens. God separated the two heavens. That first verse of Genesis actually says in the beginning, God separated the two heavens. And the Nabu Shema, of course, that's Shemayim, Shema'im in Arabic and so forth. Shapli Shematum Shema Lazakrat. Shapli, Shafala, Shafala, Sheflam, Shefel, what is below, and that which was below, Shuma Lazakrat, its name, what's the name? Shame, Isham, name, Ismun, La Ismi, Ismael, and so forth, Ishmael, name is God, and so forth. Lazakrat, what's Zachariah? Means to name, to remember, Zachariah in Arabic, Zachariah in Hebrew, Zachariah, and so forth. It's the same one. And the name was not, names were not given to things. So it goes along the same as, familiar, but it's the old Babylonian, 1100. Most scholars, however, don't agree with Lambert. They still would put it back to the beginning of the Babylonian period. They would put it back around 1900 B.C., but still it was older than that. But this is the way it goes then. As once above, when the heavens had not yet received their name, received a frame from everlasting, thou art God, to endless years the same. Remember the hymn, the old congregational hymn, we have it in our book. Before the hills in order stood, earth received her frame, for everlasting thou art God. It's the school song at Berkeley. It's very old, goes back to University of California. Used to be a congregational school originally starting out. As once above, when the heavens had not yet received their name, and the earth below was not yet named, the Holy of Holies, the most inner sacred sanctuary of the temple. See, the temple is the central point, the place where you go for the creation story and all the rest of the temple. Had not yet been built. It's the Gipara. There's been a lot written about it, but the Gipara. It's the sacred Holy of Holies, the innermost chamber of the temple. When the gods were born from the bosom of Apsu and Tiamat. Notice Apsu. There is another familiar word to all of us. The Greeks pick that up and they use it a great deal, religion and so forth. Apsu as Tiamat. And Tiamat is the Hebrew word. In the Old Testament, it's Tahom. The Tahom. And the Apsu is our word abyss. Notice the abyss. Dove-like in the creation, remember in Milton? Dove-like sats brooding on the vast abyss and made it pregnant. Well, this is the vast, which is the old Babylonian and the old Sumerian. It's very old, you see. Old word for the abyss, the emptiness, the void that wasn't there before. But it's not, of course. It's Tiamat. It has stuff in it. It's deorganized. See, Tiamat means disorganized. And in the 75th section of the Book of the Dead, where it describes the flood, that because of the wickedness of God, he says that things, I will cause a flood to come, and things will return to the hu-hu and muhu, which they were before the creation. That means the disorganized state of chaos. And that's what Tiamat is, the Tehom of the Old Testament. She is the woman. She is the... And she comes right down into Gnostic literature as Sophia, and from which things have to be organized, the Apsu and Tiamat. And, see, I left something out here, because it calls her here in the text, it calls her Mumu. Mother calls her Mumu. The same, Mumu is the same thing as Tiamat. You notice there's always this tension between the matriarchy and the patriarchy, you know, especially in Babylon. In Egypt, there's remarkable equality. They keep things very even there. But here you have this trouble anyway. Ages passed, and Anshar and Kishar, the nobler race of gods, were born. You see, you have issues coming along and along. Things were going on long before this. See, this is not just the beginning. It's like when the creator, Ta, he calls a meeting to settle a long-standing affair between Horus and Set. It had been going on. And it's the same thing. And this, in the case, was between Anshar and Kishar, the nobler race. The days passed, the years followed, Anshar begot Anu, the firstborn equal to himself. So Anu is the high god, the god of heaven, the one that you usually attribute. He's Vadi in the case of Ptah, is Anu. You don't have to remember these, but just notice we're following the same pattern here. Who was Anu, and the firstborn equal to himself, Anshar and Anu. See, there's the father and the son, equal to himself. Again, you get the same thing in the other text. He begot him in his own image. Notice, Tamishlashu, Mashallah. How would you say in Arabic? Like it. Mitlo. Mathala is to be like, to have an image. And in Hebrew, of course, it's Mashal. In Hebrew, you say, for example, the Mashal, to give an example. But Mashal is an image or likeness, an example. And it says here, way in this old Babylonian, Ta Mashila Shu. Mashal, according to, Shu means his, of course, according to his, Mashila, according to his image and to his own likeness and image. Matala. And this was Nu Dimun. That's the one who's to be on the earth, which is exactly like our Tachen as far as goes. This is the title given to Ea as the creator of mankind. It was he who was the creator, we are told. He who was a vast intelligence. Remember, Pearl of Great Price, I am more intelligent than they all. A vast intelligence, omniscient, omnipotent, mightier than the father of his father, Anshir. So we have generations, patriarchal line of descent here. The women bothering things here, Tiamat, because she's going to make trouble. Now we begin the story. There was a great assembly among the brethren of the gods to resist the influence of Tiamat, that's our Tehom, the power of darkness, the underworld. They began to take measures. There was much stirring, Shu'aru, much ado, Shara, simply to do, in the heavenly mansions. For Apshu, the abyss here, and Tiamat, the female who ruled over it, this member, they represent entropy. They want everything to return to a state of chaos and to a state of death and stillness. That's what things are doing. They're all running down. That's say rules anyway. It's as if these people had an insight into the modern physics. These powers, they're trying to break it down and we're trying to build it up against them. But that's the very meaning of what they have. Tohu wa bohu, it starts out, see in the Old Testament, tohu wa bohu is still used, it's modern Greek, if you mean Hebrew, if you mean complete conclusion, what's going on at home? It's a mess, tohu wa bohu, the whole thing, not organized. So the same thing here. For Apshu, the abyss, and Tiamat planned to destroy the race of gods because of their rebellious independence. They did not want man to have his agency. Remember, Satan tried to destroy the agency at the beginning. So that's the issue. Are the individuals to enjoy independence or not, or are they to revert to their primal state when everything just lazy gives up and collapses and goes down? Everything runs downhill. It's the heat death, you know. The one thing passes. It's the first law of thermodynamics, the second law of thermodynamics. Everything running down, which is the normal course of things. And of course, the problem arises, why hasn't it had taken place long before, which is quite a mystery. But then this resentment of free agency is called in the poem the beginning of evil in line 44. Their plan of destruction was reported to the gods. They heard about it, and when they heard of it, they bestirred themselves. Their discussion subsided, literally their voices became silent, and they sat perplexed. This is a vivid scene, very Babylonian. But the most intelligent, Ea the wise, in the end it always goes up to Ea. He is your Ta, depending on whether it's Ta or Atom. But Ea means the water. And the temple is called the house of Ea, which is written, the word for temple is written with a grating, a Babylonian grating, like this. And it represents the grating that was over the Tehom in the temple, the lowest part when you went down. That was the underworld, which in the bottom of the Roman temple would be the Mundus Pathet. There was a plug, a stone that was taken out once a year. This plug, the water of the underworld and so forth. That's an important thing to have. Remember, when you go to the temple up here, what will you find in the lowest place? You will find the waters of the underworld down there, where people are buried in baptism, buried with him, as Paul says, in death to arise with him again. Just as we saw Osiris having to go down to the lowest of the low and submit to the baptism and then be dragged out again. Well, then the most intelligent Ea, the wise, the wonderful counselor who knows all things, perceived their problem. Accordingly, he traced out and determined a cosmic design. He devised against the evil one his pure, irresistible utterance. He proclaimed it and placed his dwelling above the gods. He made the plan of the temple, what the Egyptian would call the center. It's always quadrateous. They always make it this way. This is the quadrata. This is basic. You find this universal throughout the world. The four parts. All our temples are boxes of the compass. Should be that one, isn't it? But they should be. That one makes that one an endowment house rather than a temple. Because that's what temple means. Temple means a template box to the compass by which we take all our measurements and so forth. Well, to go on with this anyway, he proclaimed it and placed his dwelling, notice, above the waters. Remember, we saw the waters of Nun, from which all things emerge, the cosmic waters, the waters that surround us. One of the great discoveries of our time, of course, is that we're surrounded by water in space. Now, Halley's Comet comes along, the well-known dirty snow barrel, it's nearly all water. And you get clear out to Uranus there, and you know, water-covered planets. He devised against them, and after he had enchained the enemy, remember Satan is bound in chains, and overcome, he, Aeas, celebrated his victory. He entered his chamber to rest and relax. He called his chamber Apsu, the abyss, because he had built it over the prison of his victim, kept down there. And in this sacred place of destinies, the temple of divination, the god was begotten in the bosom of Apsu. Marduk was born. Marduk is the savior. Now, this is the god who was worshipped at Babylon. Remember, this is a sectarian doctrine, as we told before. Ea is not the principal god at Babylon, Anu isn't either. He's the sky god, all right. It is Marduk. It's the Hebrew Marduk. And he was perfect, endowed with double divine nature. His dimensions are incomprehensible, exquisite. He cannot be described. The sight has difficulty comprehending him. Very long here. Tiamat conspired against the gods then, sending forth the dragon serpent to fight them. Man and the dragon. It was the Hydra, the red dragon. These things all have association with the stars. These things are transferred, these episodes, to the heavens above. That's why we have them today. The biggest constellation is Ophiuchus, which is the serpent, winds clear halfway around the heavens, a very important thing. And that's the Hydra. It's not one of the houses of the zodiac, but they come in here too. The red dragon, the Lamahu, the ravening lion, the mad wolf. See, these are the creatures that tear down and destroy. And in the Norse mythology, in the end, in the Ragnarok, when all the gods shall come to an end and everything subside, everything collapse, everything pass away, then the Fenris wolf will take over, and the mad wolf, the ravening lion, the Lamahu, and the world will revert to the confusion and disorganization with which it began. It's a tragic ending. But this theme is the same one. But they're fighting against each other. This is opposition. She exalted her son Kingu as the rival of Marduk. So we have this, the Horus and Seth rival here. The combat is going to take place. There's going to be a ritual combat between them. Kingu and Marduk. Their name is the board. They're important. Marduk and the son of Tiamat, her favorite, who was to be the champion, was Kingu. You notice there's a lot medieval in this. This whole thing was taken over in the chivalric order in the Middle Ages, and you get all this sort of focus going on there. And she directed her host against the gods of heaven. She enthroned Kingu, gave him the tablets of destiny, and established them to his dress. Now, the 12 tablets of destiny, remember, the high priest in Israel had to have 12 stones on a breastplate attached to his breast, and they represented the 12 months of the 12 tribes. But they also represent the destinies, each month of the year. This has to do with the zodiac and all the rest. But the tablets of destiny you have to have. And in order to rule, you have the tablets of destiny. The Egyptians are the same way with the necessity of having the documents. See, the king must have his mekkis. We have those big photographs of the giant photograph of Ramses. He's holding a document, a folded document in his hand. That's the mekkis with his name. You can see his name is sealed on it. It's his right to rule, his genealogy, as a matter of fact. It gives him his right and his legitimacy. But you have to have that. And here you have to have these tablets of destiny. You're not going to have anything. She gave him the tablets of destiny, attaching them to his breast, like the 12 stones of the high priest. Well, in heaven there was a consternation and another council. Anshar remained alarmed. He gazed at the ground and groaned. It's a vivid picture here. He gazed at the ground and groaned. He shook his head, he ground his teeth, he turned to Ea, he said, shaking his locks. Zeus, shaking his locks. Same thing as in the Aeneid. Caput extollit unda, with Poseidon, the god who shakes his locks, and Zeus shakes his, they're not called black, they're called purple, they're so black. He shakes his black locks when he's in a rage or distress, and he does the same thing. He gazed at the ground, he groaned, he hit his side, he turned to Ea and shook his head. Then they called an assembly of all the gods, the Anunnaki, the assembled gods. Anunnaki means the gods in assembly. They're embarrassed. They kept their lips closed, all sat in abashed silence. No god was willing to move against Tiamat. She was too mighty. For none could survive such an encounter. Who can survive the powers of destruction and despair? See, when Moses feared, then he knew the bitterness of hell, and he was finished if he hadn't been rescued at the last moment. He couldn't stand up to it. The same thing here. Then the Lord Anshar, father of the gods, arose in majesty, and having thought deeply, he spoke. He who is mighty of power, the avenger of his father, Marduk the hero, shall overcome the power of opposition. So they have chosen their hero to go and win the victory for them. And the Lord who rejoices at the word of his father, this is Marduk, he received the assignment gladly, rejoices at the word of his father with radiant heart, spake to his father thus, Lord of the gods, destiny of the great gods, if I am to be the avenger, call an assembly, and render to me my all-powerful calling, and proclaim it in the great assembly, where all may rejoice together. And want this openly and clearly, the power appointed to me among all the gods. So it would be recognized who it was, if they were willing to let him do the dirty work. In the great assembly, where all may rejoice together, that my word may establish the destiny even as yours, that whatsoever I may create shall also be eternal, that the command of thy lips, my lips, may be firm and unchanging. Notice the command of my lips is a shephat, exactly as used in the Hebrew and in the Egyptian. Remember the Enuma Elish, the utterance of his mouth, the thought of his mind, the logos, and the shall be firmly established. And it's by the creation of the word. Notice that my word may establish the destinies as yours, that the command of my lips may be firm and unchanging. That might just as well be an Egyptian statement. It might be from the Old Testament or anything like that. Remember, you must have the word in order to communicate. God doesn't work in a vacuum, alone. Look, we share a common universe of discourse, but how? As we say before, your sensory organs receive it, but they don't give it out. There's only one way you can tell how you have constructed the universe inside. And we know perfectly well that the impulses that come to your senses are nothing but electrical impulses. They have no structure or anything else. You have to build it all up here, as it says in the Enuma Elish, then it goes to your heart and it receives its form, and then it's repeated on the tongue, and by the word you convey it to others and share it with others. There is no end to my works or my words, and this is my glory, to share it with the rest of them. It can only be done through the word. Therefore, there's nothing particularly mysterious about the Logos, which is very important if you're going to communicate and prove that there's more than one universe. How do I know that I'm not a solipsist, that I'm not inventing it all myself, that you're my dream? You see, you have dreams. I have dreams of teaching classes and being all confused like I am today, and rather terrible, terrible dreams. But how do I know this isn't a dream? You see, because we can communicate. We can share and show, well, your picture matches mine pretty well and so forth. But see, the great evil of the deception by the word Satan, he was a liar from the beginning. He is the one who loves and makes a lie. If I start telling you what my universe is, and you have no right to contradict me, if I tell you what I see and what I hear and what I remember, and I'm lying to you, I fake it, see, well, I've thrown everything away. There's no world between us. There's no universe. I've brought confusion upon the whole plan of raising God's children up, the plan by which he spreads his glory. Remember, this is my work and my glory. So the lie is the worst possible sin you can... Satan is the old deceiver and the destroyer, but he works. He's the one who loves and makes a lie, and how easy it is to do. But what a great offense that is, you see, to say, you may be quite serious. He takes it for granted you mean what you say. He has no means of knowing whether you do or not, because good liars are very clever. They take such an important part in Shakespeare's plays, the deception that builds around it. And it's the one that leads to tragedy all the time. Somebody lies, and then you're in real trouble. Well, so this is the word, same word he's talking about here. I say it's surprising that they talk about the Logos as a great mystery and nothing to be explained. But if we're of the same universe of discourse as God, well, you see, that's where it comes in. We are of the same universe of discourse as God. Therefore, the word can exchange between us. He understands our language. We understand his. Whereas the Christian world accepts right from the beginning, right from Alexandria, God is the totalitarian. He's totally other. He can have no communication. He's nothing like us in any sense whatsoever. So it doesn't go there. Well, let's get along with our text here. Tablet number 3. At the assembly, Marduk is proclaimed as the Savior. Henceforth be thy command unalterable. Marduk, we have given unto thee the universal dominion over all things. and make you Lord over the earth and everything on the face of the earth. He says, here, here. Take thy place in the assembly. Let thy word be sovereign there. Let thy destiny, Shemaika, be the same as that of the gods. That whatsoever thy word commands, notice the power of the word here, whatsoever thy word commands shall be created and destroyed as thou commandest. Speak and matter shall vanish. Speak again and the same matter return intact. Marduk spoke and behold, material vanished. He spoke again, dissolved, vaporized, turned into another form, see. He spoke again and the material took substance. When the gods, his fathers, saw that he had this power to create in his word, they said, he is qualified. He had proved it, you see, by this. They rejoiced and they venerated him. Marduk is our king, and they gave him the scepter and the throne and the crown, the palim. Tablet number 4. Marduk confronts the powers of the evil, charging Tiamat. Thou wouldst exalt his king's power to be... And of course, they have the sycamothea, the exchange of insults before the fight, which is part of epic literature. Thou wouldst exalt his Kingu's power, her son Kingu's power, to be equal to that of God Anu on high. Having overcome Kingu in battle, he chained him and put him in the custody of the god Ugu, who took from him the tablets of destiny to which he had no lawful right. Then Marduk progressed through the heavens, inspecting their places, the various worlds, and there he established a new world, an exact replica of the Apsu, the dwelling of Ea, remember, like unto the other worlds we have hitherto created, same thing here, following the heavenly pattern, as President Joseph F. Smith said, this earth, in its natural state, is exactly like the world that the earth came when it came from the hand of God, and it's a duplicate of his own, he says. Anyway, an exact replica of the Apsu, the dwelling of Ea, Most High. The Lord Marduk took its measurements. Measurements are extremely important here. He built the Midot, the famous Midot. He built his own palace, the Esharu, the temple of Eridu, the first temple on earth, representing the earth itself at creation. Notice the name of Eridu, Eretz, Aretz, earth. We've had that before and before. After its pattern, the palace of Eshara, which he built, was thus the heaven itself. The temple is a scale model of the universe, is what it's supposed to be. He caused Anu, Enlil, and Ea, the 3 degrees of glory, to come and occupy the temple for its dedication here. Then, tablet 6, Marduk resolved upon a wondrous work. He'd make the human race. He'd bring them down. He opened his mouth and addressed his father Ea and told him, see, it's Christ that made possible for the human race to come here, because otherwise they wouldn't have. We'll see that in the next one I read it, which will take a little time. I told him of what he had conceived in his heart. I wish to bring, notice, it was Ta who conceived in his heart, always there. But he wished to bring forth blood and bone. I wish to bring them forth and put them together to organize them into a human being. His name shall be man, Amelu. Well, let it be his duty to serve the gods and satisfy them. And in order that there be satisfaction, Marduk proposed a plan to the gods. Quote, let one of their race be put to death, that humanity might be, one be made an offering for others. Let one of the assembled gods be delivered up as a guilty one, that they might subsist. Well, this is the plan of salvation, of course, the Lord making the supreme sacrifice, being suggested at this time to make the plan workable on earth when men should come down. Well, Kingu was defeated. Oh, Kingu opposed the plan. Well, we know that from our Pearl of Great Price. It was he who made Tiamat rebel and caused the war. And it was because of the war, not because he opposed it, but because of the war and the violence he introduced, that Kingu was defeated and cast down, and the great assembly gave all the power of heaven and earth to Anu for carrying out the execution of the plan. Then he established with great care the ways of the earth, assigning to the gods of heaven and earth the laws that should apply here. Shabak was stone against him. A city was built like unto another Babylon. They labored on it for a year. A second year was devoted to building the temple, which was the replica of the heavenly halls above. After first erecting the great tower over the Apsu, they built the threefold house of Marduk, Enlil, and Ea, the temple all in its 3 degrees of glory. Remember, Peter says, let us build 3 shrines here, one to thee, and one to Elijah, and one to God, so forth. Marduk, Enlil, and Ea, I think that was the order. The Anunnaki, the assembly gods themselves, designed these holy shrines at Esagil, which is the temple of Babylon. This is to celebrate the founding of the temple of Babylon, Esagil, just exactly as the Enuma Elis was to celebrate the temple, the White House at Memphis, the temple of Ptah. So we're nearly finished here. All all came together in the great assembly at the place to dedicate it. There Marduk ordered all the fathers and all his gods to be seated and addressed them thus. This is Babylon, the place to which you shall come hereafter. Come together to rejoice at this place at the season of the great festival year after year. Sounds like Israel. Thus the rites were installed and the laws were fixed and the destinies decreed. There were seven gods fixed the destinies of the human race. May God rule over them forever as their shepherd. Remember the Egyptian pharaoh out there has the shepherd's crook and the flail that the shepherd uses. Let him rule over them as their shepherd, and when they gather here under his protection, let them rehearse throughout the ages to come at this spot what God has done, that they may never forget it. When we go to the temple, we rehearse the creation all over again. That's what you're supposed to do. For this is the earthly image of that which was done in heaven. Let the blackheads, that's the human race, the Babylonians, remember their prayers to the gods, knowing that for us, by whatever name we call him, we have only one God, and he is our God. Truly, we have given him 50 names. It is he who nourishes and sustains us, whose mighty arm protects us against the elements of our enemies. It sounds like the prophets in the Psalms, doesn't it? Upon mankind he has created, he has placed the obligation of serving him, that they be satisfied. Great planner, full of mercy and loving kindness, may he forgive their sins and deliver them by his grace. For Marduk is God, the creator of all things. Verily he sustains the land and its people. It is he whom the nations acclaim, Lord of gods of heaven and earth. Sounds like the ending of the Hallelujah chorus here, doesn't it? Because it is, they end in a grand chorus at the end. He is the Lord who by his pure utterance, his incantation, his shiptushu, shepet, notice shiptu is the word, shepet, the Hebrew word shepet, lip, and safat, of course, in Arabic, saftun, his pure utterance raises the gods from the dead. You back to your resurrection motif, then you never get away from that. He is the pure God who purifies our ways. Let us praise him. They have taken their places in the assembly to declare his names in the holy place. Let all together proclaim his name, and then they all join in the Hallelujah chorus at the end. So this is quite a show for the principal religious doctrine of the Mesopotamians. We think of corrupt Babylon and so forth. Of course it became corrupt. They all became corrupt. But this was their basic doctrine. This was built around this. After it's been shuffled around and scrambled, these motifs, but you recognize they're all there, and they hold together, and this makes a theme, which again gave great solidity to the empire and was the center of the political structure and everything else.